8.
The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Thinman. Thank you so much for tuning in on this glorious summer day. I hope you're just chillaxing and maybe having a nice coffee in the backyard under the patio umbrella or something similar like that. In this half hour of the show, we are going to be interviewing the editor of the Allgemeine Journal, Simon Jacobson. He's been on the show before. And we're going to be talking about the late Elie Wiesel of blessed memory. And his family has had a personal relationship with him, and that's what we're going to be focusing on. The first half of the hour of the show, we'll be featuring some very nice brand new Jewish music that's come up. And the portion of the week is the portion of Chukas, which can be found in the Book of Numbers and following, a very poignant story about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the anniversary of whose passing was commemorated yesterday. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Israeli forces destroyed Syrian army positions following stray gunfire from Syria, which landed near an Israeli security fence. Still on the Syrian side, but near enough. They got blown up. Israeli authorities investigating the Sarona Market terrorist shootings that left 4 people dead say that the 2 terrorists involved in the attack were members of ISIS. So it's spreading. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Entebbe, Uganda, to take part in the ceremony marking the 40th year anniversary of the famous Entebbe operation, in which the IDF rescued hostages taken from a hijacked Air France plane. Netanyahu's brother, Yonatan, was one of the 4 Israelis killed in the operation. Netanyahu also visited Rwanda, Kenya, and Ethiopia. Netanyahu will be entertaining the president of Paraguay this week. Now you got his whole itinerary there. Aircraft debris believed to have come from an Egypt Air crash in May has washed up on a beach in Netanya near Tel Aviv. The plane parts will be handed over to Egypt. Experts are still investigating the cause of the May 19th crash of the Airbus A320, which went down in the eastern Mediterranean on a flight from Paris to Cairo, killing all 66 people on board. 4 members of the remaining Yemen Jewish community were released from Yemeni jails, after being held for 3 months. The 4 were accused of smuggling a Torah scroll out of the country to Israel with the last wave of emigrants. You're not allowed to do such things because it was considered a national treasure. There are currently 50 Jews living in Yemen who have chosen not to leave. And finally, speaking of Kenya before, Kenya will receive assistance from Israel to construct a 440-mile wall to prevent Somali terrorists from coming into that country. Israel is in the process of building a security fence along its southern border with Jordan and also expanding the fence along the Sinai Peninsula and has plans to build an underground wall to prevent terrorists from Gaza tunneling into Israel, as reported right here on the Jewish Hour. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000. 858-9000 or visit them on the web at spexhoward.edu. Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We are on live with Simone Jacobson, who is the editor-in-chief of the Allgemeine Journal. We're talking about Elie Wiesel of blessed memory, who passed away last week. How are you today, Simone?
Thank you very much. And you, Herschel?
Thank God, we're doing very well. Okay, I believe your family had a relationship with Elie Wiesel?
Yes, we did.
So tell us about it.
Well, beginning with my father, who passed away 11 years ago, Gershon Jacobson, was a pretty well-known journalist. He became friendly with Elie Wiesel in the late 50s, when they were both fledgling journalists. Elie Wiesel at the time was the correspondent for the largest daily Hebrew paper called the Yediot Ahronot. And in 1960, when he went off to publish his first book, Night, in English, he asked my father to take over his position. And over those years, they were very close, as they both developed into each in their own way. And I got to know Elie Wiesel once I was a little older, and my father introduced me to him. And then after my father passed away, he was an ongoing columnist at the Allgemeine Journal, which my father founded in 1972, ongoing columnist. And so we maintained the relationship and actually developed and grew. I used to go see him every few months. We talked for hours and hours. So I know he told me that he gave credit to my father for helping him start to look at life a little positively after the darkness, as he expresses in the book Night. But that's where the relationship began. Yeah, my mother obviously also knew Mr. Wiesel, and I can't say we were the closest family friends, but they were professionally and personally very close to each other. When my father passed away, he was the first man I called, and he came from Greenwich, Connecticut, to the Levaya, the funeral in Brooklyn, spoke a few words, and ever since been really an asset and ally to us in our work at the Allgemeine, and always supported us both with his presence, with his talks, and even financially. So obviously, I have a personal debt to him, and I'm honored to be able to say a few words.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would you say that it was that book, Night, that really propelled him into, like, the world view, or was there something even before that? Night, I understand, was, like, really considered one of the first English-language Holocaust memorials. It's still, you're talking, it's 12 years after the Holocaust. A lot of stuff wasn't coming out yet. What would your assessment be there, Simone?
Well, he himself told me, and he's, I think, written about it as well. Right after the war, he went into complete, as many Holocaust survivors, completely traumatized. He lost his father. He lost his sister, obviously other family members. And then the personal trauma of the whole thing, especially in Night, how he devastatingly describes even his loss of faith. So for, I think, for 10 years after the war, he was completely silent. I believe he was inspired by an author in France, Maurice, I don't remember his full name right now, who encouraged him and convinced him that he's a witness and he needs to begin to write. And at that point, he was writing in French and Yiddish, and he began to write his story. And I believe Night was originally in French, and it came out around 10 years after the war, like 1956 or 55. In 1960 or 61, it was translated and published. And I think initially Night was not received that well. It was a few thousand copies. But, I mean, my understanding is that the wound was so raw and so open, people were not even able to really fathom this whole Holocaust. But then, a few years later, the book began to really get its legs, so to speak, and became what I hear from many people, the first introduction they had to the devastation and the sheer horror of the Holocaust.
I remember.
And by the way, it was a word that Wiesel never used. He never wanted to use, just for the record, Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. What did he call it? Or didn't he?
Nazi death camps.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure exactly the words he used. I don't even know why he didn't use it. I think he didn't want to give a name to anything.
Uh-huh.
It was almost like somewhat quantify, you know, that now it has a name type of thing. It was just like something completely beyond description. Mm-hmm. And yes, I hear from many people. People write about how Knight was the first book because it started becoming required studies in schools and became the first book that people read about the events. I mean, Holocaust literature really did not take off till, if you could use that word, till the late 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. I think it was because it was too close, and it was just not something people wanted to hear. And the people who were witnesses, well, I don't think were ready to speak. I mean, I guess this is somewhat speculation. I don't have hard facts, but I think that was what it was.
Mm-hmm. So was it really his being an author that made him, like, world famous? He did receive the Nobel Peace Prize, and he didn't get it in literature. He got it for, as a statesman, a diplomat around the world, encouraging peace among humanity.
I think that would catapulted him for sure into the world stage, the Nobel Prize. Until that point, he was an author, he was writing books, and he had influence, and his name was around. But I think the Nobel Prize had that power because it created that type of unique... I would say it's a combination of factors. He obviously was a very moving and oratory presence. He had a mastery of words, and he had that look and feel, so to speak, of a survivor. The wrinkles on his face, if I may put it that way, and he kept at it. I think I don't say he cultivated himself as the ultimate Holocaust representative. I'm sure there are critics of it, but he did maintain a certain consistent voice against all inhumanity. After the Nobel Prize, he established his foundation and began to call out against atrocities in Darfur and in Somalia and in Bosnia, etc., later in Iran. And he became, a combination of all of that, his so-called charisma and his ongoing writing and his teaching as well in Boston University and his lectures at 92nd Street Y. They all combined to be that type of presence, if you were to analyze it.
You're kind of segueing into, maybe you even just answered the question. I think it was like 2008, 2009. It was right after, probably 2009, maybe 2010, that President Obama met with Elie Wiesel, and he said for the first time. And he said in the press conference afterwards, Obama said that he felt humbled in the presence of Elie Wiesel. So what was it about it that he's the President of the United States, is the most powerful person in the free world or even in the world, and to make such a statement that he felt like nothing in Elie Wiesel's presence, Simon Jacobson?
The president say things, some of them are good sound bites. Let's assume that he meant it sincerely. I would say that Wiesel projected an image of suffering. When he spoke, you could see, even when he smiled, there was an agony. And I think Oprah Winfrey said similar words when she went with him to Auschwitz. And she chose his book, which also, by the way, like really took it to another level. I think in his presence you felt a person who suffered greatly and was maintaining his fortitude to move forward. And that is humbling because, you don't see that every day. We live, thank God, in a world where people are comfortable. So when you suddenly see a type of sufferer, person that came like an ember from the ashes, and which he very clearly projected all the time, I think that is humbling. That probably mostly explain the president's words.
Mm-hmm. Now, he came to speak in Detroit a couple times that I know of, and he identified himself as, when he would speak for Lubavitcher, he'd start off his speech with, I'm not a Lubavitcher, I'm really a Vizhnitzer. That's the way he would start. But he did have a connection, a very close connection with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Do you know any of the stories, Simon Jacobson?
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I heard from him directly, and he's written up some of them. I think good some history here because there are some really interesting points that I think people are not aware of Wiesel, especially in his personal life. So, Knight captured his story, which was Knight. It was endless Knight. And he felt he didn't deserve to live. He definitely did not want to marry and have children and bring them into such a dark world. And as he writes, Knight, the smoke of the furnaces and the death camps, his faith, his belief, his God went up in that smoke. It was very, very depressing. And in the early 60s, he told me that my father was an influence, as I mentioned. But my father suggested he go see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And at first he didn't want to, because he said, what's the point, you know? But he went to see him, and they had a long audience. I think it was supposed to be 20 minutes. It ended up being several hours. And then subsequently, in 1965, the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, whose yahrzeit, by the way, is tomorrow, Shabbos, wrote him a long letter. And in it, he talks about faith and atheism and basically stating that only a person of faith could really have questions about the Holocaust, because a non-believer shouldn't have issues with justice altogether. At the end of the letter, he says to him that the ultimate response to the final solution of the Nazis is to build a family, because that's what they wanted. They wanted the end of the Jewish line, the Jewish descendants. And by not building a family, not marrying, not having children, you're essentially feeding into their plan. And Wiesel told me that that was it shocked him that he received that from the Rebbe. The Rebbe even writes to him, I hope before Shavuos we hear any news about you getting married. And he was like taken aback, but then as he thought about it, he said, and the Rebbe kept on persisting, he realized the Rebbe was 100% right, that he was succumbing and giving in to that type of mentality. And then interesting exchange, you talk about visions to Lubavitch. So when he came to the Rebbe said to him, he immediately qualified and said, you know, I'm a visionist, a chassid. I'm not going to become a Lubavitch, a chassid. So the Rebbe said, you're a chassid. That's the main thing. And then this like almost humorous exchange went back and forth, because he came also for a Simchas Torah, and the Rebbe said to him, say l'chaim. And he said, I'm not a Lubavitch. He says, in visions, they say l'chaim. Absolutely. So he said, l'chaim. So the Rebbe said, and visions, they say a second l'chaim? For sure. And then in visions, do they say more l'chaim? Absolutely. And the Rebbe said, and Lubavitch too. So in an interesting way, the Rebbe like transcended the vision of Lubavitch and other distinctions, which the Rebbe, of course, did with everyone in that sense. They're not any Jew is a Jew, and that's that, and there were no labels and names. And they maintain that type of, somewhat lighthearted distinction. He remains a visionist, and not becoming a Lubavitch. And from the Rebbe's point of view, it's perfectly fine. You know, we need diversity, and you be a visionist and be a good visionist. You know?
Mm-hmm. So he was older when he got married, wasn't he?
He got married in 1969. Now, he was born in 1928, so let's do the math.
That's 41.
41 years old. Yeah, I mean, relatively. In 1972, they had a son. One son, his name is, whom he named movingly after his father, Shlomo Elisha. And I remember sitting in his office once in Madison Avenue, and he stood up, went over to the photos on his desk, and he looked at his son as a young child and looked at his grandchild, and he said, and this is worth it all. So it was very clear that his marriage and his family was redemptive for him, a real redemption from the dark and the horrors that he had witnessed. And he openly gave credit that it was not due to his own doing. It was due to the Lubavitcher Rebbe's inspiration, which convinced him that that's the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if you're just joining us, our guest today is Simone Jacobson, who's the editor of the Allgemeine Journal newspaper, which is available online at allgemeine.com. And you can order it and have it mailed directly to your home, too. We're talking about the late Elie Wiesel of blessed memory. So you said you mentioned that he was a columnist for the Allgemeine Journal. What kind of things did he write about? Did he write every week about the Holocaust?
No. Like his books. I mean, his initial first books are about the Holocaust. But then he would write humorous pieces. He wrote about his own Hasidic dynasties. You could write a column about the Hasidic melody. I think he even did one something in the 92nd Street Y on Hasidic music, singing some songs. And he would write commentary about Israel, about current events. Yeah, but there was always an undercurrent in the cumulative message in all his articles was fighting injustice and speaking up when you see inhumanity, man to man. But many interesting articles. He would write a column, was right on the op-ed page for years, I think over 10 years, a weekly column in Yiddish. As a matter of fact, one of the events we did to honor the Allgemeiner, and he was there, we presented him with a journal of all his articles. We collected them together. Oh, not all, I can't say all, but a collection of them. It was very diverse, very diverse. And as you know, he taught in Boston University and other universities. It wasn't Holocaust studies. He would teach Talmud. He considered himself a teacher. He told me, I'm a Malamed, teaching Gemara, Talmud. He loved Talmud, and he loved the parables, and he would analyze them. And that was basically Jewish Torah messages about life. And so I think there was a whole side to him that was very non-Holocaust. It was really going back to his own childhood in Yeshiva, Cheder, in Siget, where he was born, in Hungary, Romania. So pretty diverse in that sense. Mm-hmm. I think his books also, he has Hasidic Tales, he has Souls on Fire. Mm-hmm. Many of his books are not necessarily Holocaust-based.
Okay, understood. This is an obvious question with an obvious answer, but has the Algemeiner found somebody to replace Elie Wiesel? It's a hard act to follow.
Well, he wrote in Yiddish, but he didn't continue. The column was, like, I think from 1972 to around 1985.
Uh-huh.
He didn't continue the column. For us, as when I took over after my father's passing in 2005 as publisher and editor, he would write from time to time. I would ask him. I remember there was the massacre at Mumbai. There were some other events that he would write. He'd usually write it up in Yiddish. We would translate it. But he wasn't regular. I mean, he served for us at the Algemeiner really a crucial time. This is after my father's passing, to help us really transition into an online entity, Algemeiner.com, and raise the money for it, and create events and galas and so on. And he was a speaker. I remember 3 years ago, he was the main speaker. We honored him because he called us Warrior for Truth. So he made a Warrior for Truth award, and we gave it to Elie Wiesel. And Harvey Weinstein of Hollywood fame accepted an invitation to present it to him, which was quite a surprise to us all. And when he spoke about his affinity and how Schindler's List, I think Weinstein was behind that, was all due to Wiesel. It was a very interesting exchange there. You know, storytellers. And I introduced them both, and I said, we have something all in common. We're all storytellers. So with that, he helped us tremendously in really opening up stores and just creating the support needed to really maintain Algemeiner.com, which is a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. So, again, that's another debt that I feel honored to repay in any way possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you could boil it down, a person's life and their accomplishments, what lessons should we now take with us from the life of Elie Wiesel, Simon Jacobson?
That's a great question. I mean, the most obvious, which I don't want to state the obvious, but I cannot state it, is that he was a moral voice. And at the end of the day, he was unabashedly and unapologetically called Reagan on visiting Bitburg, and definitely was a voice that that maintained the type of defiance against inhumanities and with eloquence and so poetic way described how the silence of the world during the Holocaust should teach us never to ever allow something of that, which essentially means that each of us in our own lives have to stand up to injustice. Silence is not an option. It's if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. I think that's, you know, most obvious lesson from him because that's what he fought for. But I think there's something else which I am touched by. As he got older, and I got to know him in later years, I saw he gravitated back to his Torah roots. He loved learning. I was in his office lined with books, and I saw they were used, and they were Talmudic books, and then biblical texts and commentaries, and Maimonides and philosophical. And I think he really, the love of learning, of Jewish learning, and its timeless message is something that's somewhat overshadowed by the Holocaust witness that he was. That love of learning and realizing that ultimately Jewish eternity is not just remembering the atrocities that happened to us and just not just saying never again, but really embracing the values, the human values, the civilized values of justice and virtue, which really have only in the last few centuries become part of mainstream institutions like the United States and other countries. And the gravitating back to that I found very moving, because he didn't allow the darkness to dominate and really became a beacon of light in that sense, a teacher to many, many. I've met many of his students, and they see him as their, like their teacher, their Rebbe, their mentor. And I think that's something that's less emphasized, but to me captures really a legacy, because it's not just, okay, let's never forget the Holocaust, but what is this, what do we stand for? That's what we stand against. We can't just be anti-Semites. So what do we stand for, or anti-racism or anti-discrimination? We stand for a legacy of light, Torah, that brought such powerful values and continues to bring them. And I think that's something that each of us can learn from him as we embrace our own tradition, which has changed the world.
Wonderful. Our guest today has been Simone Jacobson, who is the editor of the Allgemeiner Journal. And his publication can be accessed at allgemeiner.com. And we want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your stories and enlightening us. We really, really appreciate it, Simone.
My pleasure, my honor, and good luck. And maybe you'll be beacons of light.
Amen. That's going to do it. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Joel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. That was really inspiring. That's like, whoa, that's a keeper. So tell your friends, you know, you heard what you heard today, and it'll be posted on www.rabbifinman.com and iTunes and Stitcher and all the other media. We have up next, for your listening pleasure, brand spanking new, this is Barry Weber together with Blue Melody. That's the accompaniment. And this song is called Shma Bani, Listen, My Son. Excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West Nine Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. This is also a pretty new song. I would say it's only 57 years old, I think. Pretty new. The group is called Salonika. It is a group from Thessalonica, which is a second largest city in Greece. And this is Greek-style Jewish music. And the song they're singing is Rachem, Have Mercy. Someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. This song that's playing, this is actually very brand new. There's a whole story to it. The composer is Sarah Dukes. She is a Lubavitch woman who is an accomplished pianist and composer. She recently won a silver medal at the Global Music Award for the song which we're going to play, which is called One, and has recently released an album, which is available on iTunes and Amazon for download. Sarah Dukes is the name, is D-U-K-E-S. We're also going to be closing with one of her songs. This, why don't we just listen to it? It's called One. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. This week's portion is the portion of Chukas, and it can be found in the Numbers chapter 18 and following. Two of the things that are mentioned in this portion are the first two, as a matter of fact, the process of purification for coming in contact with a dead body, which is known as the Para Aduma, the red cow, and which is immediately followed by the death, the passing of Miriam, Moses' sister. And after that, the well dried up, and Moses hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock, and then Aaron dies. It's not a good portion for righteous people in this portion. They seem to, everything's just going wrong. The question is asked, and it's a very famous question, and there is a very famous answer. I'm going to relay that to you now. As to why the death of Miriam was preceded by the story of the process of the red cow. The answer that's given is that, is the answer in the Talmud, that just as the chatas, the sin offering, which is what this was called, atones for sin, so too also the death of a tzaddik, of a righteous person, such as the caliber of Miriam, also atones for sin. That's the answer which is given in the Talmud. The Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, says that doesn't answer the question. The Para Aduma, the red cow, the whole process was done specifically outside of the temple. Would it not have made more sense then to have placed the death of Miriam next to the sin offering, which was brought if a person accidentally, unintentionally transgressed a prohibition, which was culpable, the death penalty? So that person had to bring a chatas, a sin offering. Wouldn't it have been better to have brought the in conjunction with that? After all, you would say, but wait a minute, that's in the book of Leviticus, and this is the book of Numbers. But the story of the Para Aduma, the process of purification over here, which is done with this red cow, really should have been in the book of Leviticus as well. But it was put here. You can't say, well, the reason why it's this way is because, well, Miriam was the first person to die, because Miriam wasn't the first person to die. She was actually one of the last people to die in the desert. There had been 40 years of people dying in the desert already. So it had nothing to do with that. I was sure there's not that many people that are mentioned as having died in the desert, but there were some. But no, that's neither here nor there. That's a non sequitur, non-answer. So the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, explains that it was specifically the counteracting of death. Because what is death? Death is, doesn't it says, if you're talking about inside and outside as far as godliness is concerned, there is nothing more outside than death. Death is an unnatural occurrence, believe it or not. People ask, well, how is the resurrection going to happen? Well, the resurrection, it's not like, you know, you can have the Messiah walking around, going to all the graves and saying, okay, everybody, get up. No, not going to be that. Okay, he talks about the Tekaba shofar guttle, the blowing of the great shofar, the ram's horn. Okay, we're getting closer. The way that the resurrection is going to occur is that the concept of death will be removed. You remember when Adam was first created way back in Genesis 1:1 and 2:1, he wasn't supposed to die. It was only because of his shortcomings and eating that fruit that death was introduced into the world. So the status quo is that people really should live forever. So what's going to happen? What's the Mashiach going to do? He's going to remove the block which is preventing the status quo from occurring. And by removing death from the world, so there's no such thing as death, everybody comes back alive. Simple. Oh, if were it to happen. So there's nothing outside of spirituality, nothing more outside of godliness, nothing outside of normal more than the concept of death. And here it is. So we have this juxtaposition that we talk about in great detail, the process whereby someone who has been excluded for coming in contact with a dead body, whether it was intentional, unintentional, for a mitzvah even, there's a mitzvah to bury people. Whatever the rationale may have been, the reason may have been that this person is now excluded from entering the temple. So the process is undertaken. The person does the whole thing. As you can look it over there in Numbers 18, and it describes it at great length. And the person is now allowed back into the temple. What does a tzaddik do? A tzaddik's whole being, their whole essence, is one of conveying godliness. There's a verse in the Torah, I believe. Can't quote verses well enough, unfortunately. I believe it's in Habakkuk that says, Tzaddik be'amunasei yichya. A tzaddik, the righteous, live by their faith. That's not saying that they trust God. No, they are the embodiment of God's faith. Moses was called the Raya Mehemne. He was called the faithful shepherd. It doesn't mean that you could trust him with your sheep. That's not what the expression faithful shepherd meant. What it meant was he was able to shepherd, as a verb, faith into the Jewish people, to instill faith in the Jewish people. Because that's what Moses's motive operandi was. His whole life, what he was this embodiment of faith in God and being able to pass it on to the Jewish people. Miriam, same deal. So we see when Miriam passed away, the water dried up. And just as it was, the first time that they ran out of water, it says they traveled 3 days into the desert. And they complained, we have no water, and they got the water from the rock miraculously. There, the association is made that the Torah, studying Judaism, is compared to water. And just as a person cannot live 3 days without water, a person should not go 3 days at the maximum without Torah. That's why the Torah is read in the synagogue, not only on Shabbos, on the Sabbath, on Saturday. It's also read on Monday morning and read on Thursday morning, so that people should never go 3 days without hearing the Torah. Ideally, a person should learn Torah every single day. I mean, Anita Bryant borrowed a motto that a day without Torah is like a day without sunshine. We never said anything when she stole it, but it's okay. We like plagiarism a little bit. Copying is best form of flattery. Anyway, so that this is, you have an MDR. You've got your minimum daily requirement because that's what makes our souls function. And it was the death of Miriam, having that void, that missing, that brought people closer, propelled them to get together and made them such that they should be worthy of entering into our own personal temples, which is our relationship with God, which will propel the Mashiach's coming very much so, even today. And then we can all go back to Jerusalem, and we can all go back to the temple and enjoy what is bestowed upon us. Speaking of enjoyment, we've got a really poignant Hasidic story coming up right after this one word. Please come back. Don't go away. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard from the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor the Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for the Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep the Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to the Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Hey, Shul Finman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me the best way? go to my website, www.rabbifinman.com. You'll be able to contact me. We have archived editions of the show. We have archived editions of the E-Parsha, Hasidic U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story, U-Parsha, all different media by which Torah and Judaism are conveyed in an hopefully entertaining and educational way. We also have the very important donations page. We're in July. May, we're almost done paying with May. Almost. We're just about ready to make tell them, okay, here, charge the card. We've got May covered. So we need people like you. It doesn't have to be great amounts. In fact, if you do it, you go to the website and you go on PayPal. You can do it reoccurring, even $5 a month, $60 a year. That's a tremendous gift in the eyes of the Jewish Hour. We are not looking, we won't refuse, but we're not looking for the $100,000 donations, nor are we expecting them. $5 a month will do it. If everybody listening would do $5 a month, I could spend an extra 3 minutes talking about this, doing a Hasidic story. So go to the website, rabbifinman.com, click on the donations page, pick a number that you're comfortable with. The universe is just chock-a-block full with all kinds of numbers, and it has to be greater than zero, though. That's the only caveat. And do it today. Don't like doing internet giving. I can understand credit cards, internets, et cetera, yada, yada, yada. Send your donation of any amount to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. The story involves the Lubavitcher Rebbe. There was a rabbi who passed away not that long ago. His name was Yosef Weinberg. He was an emissary, a roving emissary for the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Officially, his job was collecting funds for the Lubavitcher Yeshiva in Brooklyn. But the Rebbe told him, as was told to Hillel Paracher, that he should plant spirituality wherever he's gathering physicality. Meaning you're not just there as a fundraiser, you're there as a rabbi too, you know, so help these people. He traveled extensively around the world, South America, there's all kinds of stories with Brazil and Argentina and South Africa. He spent a tremendous amount of time. He got a call once, sort of late in the evening. I'm not sure where the person was from. I did hear the story from Rabbi Weinberg himself, and I think he said Brazil. And there was a problem. Somebody needed an immediate answer from the Rebbe on a problem that they were having. Maybe it was a medical thing. I don't remember that detail. And he ran immediately to, he lived in Brooklyn, ran immediately to 770 Eastern Parkway Lubavitch World Headquarters and was told that the Rebbe's secretary was in the office right now. It was late at night. It was like 10 o'clock at night. Was in the office with the Rebbe. So he had this letter that he wanted to give to the Rebbe immediately, but there's no secretary to take it in. So what did he do? He went to the Rebbe's door and slid it under the door, expecting that the Rebbe's secretary would see the letter and would bend down, pick it up, and give it to the Rebbe. As it happened, he kind of sort of stayed off to the side to see what would happen. The secretary opened the door after some time and walked out. And it was like, oh no, he didn't pick up the letter. He didn't see it. Rabbi Weinberg heard the Rebbe. He was in one of those like secretary chairs that went back and forth, had a bit of a squeak. I'm going to try to do it with my chair, but my chair doesn't squeak that I'm in. They have very good chairs here at Salem Communication. No squeaks. He heard the Rebbe's chair squeak. He heard the Rebbe get up, and he could see that the letter, the Rebbe had bent down and picked it up. He immediately went to the secretary's office and wrote in a letter of apology for his brash action. Rather than waiting for the secretary to come out, that he slipped it under the door, and he made the Rebbe to bother the Rebbe to get up and go over and bend down and pick up the letter. The Rebbe responded, "What?" This is he got an answer back to this letter. He said, "What am I here for? If not to pick up another person?" Especially such a person that another person has overlooked.
That was who the Rebbe was. We want to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have an awesome week, and we're glad and thank you for making us a part of the beginning of this week. And we hope to see you back again next week. Take care.
Pastors and pastoral staff, Faith Talk 1500 is inviting you to the fifth annual Faith Talk 1500 Pastors Masters Golf Outing on Monday.